company would like to inform all participants that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If you need assistance, please press star zero and the coordinator will be online to assist you. Thank you, sir. Your recordings have begun.
Thank you very much. This is John Fasilius from Case New Holland, and I'll be going over quite a pile of slides, about 40 slides that hopefully everybody has a copy of in front of them. And if you go right to slide two, what I intend to talk about today is some of the short-term biomass harvesting strategies that we here at Case New Holland have. I'm going to start out with a couple of comments on who Case New Holland is, and the reason I'm doing that specifically is we get into the biofeedstock area. The industry that companies like Case New Holland are starting to work with are people that are not our traditional customers. So I think it's important both our future customers in the bio industries to understand what type of equipment the ag equipment manufacturers have available and how we can work closer together. I'll talk a little bit about key strategies that we have at Case New Holland for being involved in biofeedstock, some of the equipment that we have under test. Talk a few minutes on a number of different that we've been focused on harvesting, some of the lessons learned. I've got a couple of slides in the pack here on using biofuels in our equipment on the farm, and then we'll end with a teaser slide on the ultimate harvesting and handling solution. If you haven't peeked already, you'll understand shortly why I call that a teaser slide. So going to slide number three, who is Case New Holland? Well, Case New Holland is a global OEM. We design and manufacture agricultural and construction equipment. And we're supported with approximately 1,200 dealers worldwide. We're in about 170 different countries. Now, if you go to, and we build equipment primarily with two major brands, the Case brand and the New Holland brand, and this afternoon I'm going to be focused only on the agricultural equipment. So starting on slide four, just to give you an idea of the kind of a lineup of equipment, a full line OEM Case IH agricultural side is, we've got the equipment in the lineup that will take us through soil preparation all the way through harvesting. I mentioned we have two brands, both the Case IH brand and the New Holland brand. There is a fair amount of differentiation between our two brands, and there is some exclusive equipment that both of the brands have. Here on slide four, two of the pieces exclusive to Case IH, down on in the lower center, the harvesting equipment, the cotton picker and the sugar cane harvester. The sugar cane harvester today is a key piece in our equipment lineup for working with the bio industry, in particular in South America, working in the sugar cane and the ethanol production for Brazil. If you go to slide five, the New Holland lineup, also a full-line company brand of equipment, and like the Case IH brand side of our company, from exclusive equipment down in the lower left-hand side, the grape harvester is an example, one that you'll see quite a bit throughout this presentation on the lower right-hand, second one in, the forage harvester, and so these products, the forage harvester in particular, today is playing a significant role in the bio industry. Here in the States, with woody crops, in Europe in particular, supporting the biogas or the methane generation industry. So with that, that's who we are. So slide six, we'll jump into the short-term biomass strategy that we have, and it's a pretty simple strategy. We intend to be involved very significantly in North America, South America, and Western Europe as agricultural or agricultural-like crops are being harvested for bioenergy. Our key focus is in the production and harvesting of these crops. simply with minimal changes or tuning of our current product lines. And in the real scope of our work is in the field. Now, to do this well, we need to understand the storage needs and transportation needs and understand any of the specific conversion sensitivities to the product and what we can do in the field to try to add value as it's in the field. So if one of these conversion processes needs a particular particle size, or if moisture is a determining factor, these are all the sorts of things that we are trying to address and better understand now as we're working with these different feedstocks. Going to slide 8, the type of equipment that we have under test today and what we're focusing on, slide 8, in the crop production and crop establishment between our seeders and planters, we're trying to take advantage of what we have today for establishing certain crops like switchgrass with some of our seeding equipment, energy sorghum with our planters. The types of things we are not addressing right now are things like miscanthus that starts with that you have to have a rhizome to get going, or things like willows and poplar where you need a stick or a pole for establishment. We're going to leave those on the table for some of the short liners, but where we can get a more typical type seed through our current equipment, those are what we're working with today for crop establishment. Slide 9, the crop protection side, particularly in the early stages of getting crops established, we've been doing quite well with our current line of equipment. One of the biggest challenges that we've run across, and I think everybody needs to be careful of, is watching for pesticides that are actually labeled for these energy crops, particularly the very non-traditional crops. Slide 10, just an overview shot of some of the self-propelled equipment that we're working with, and we'll talk quite a bit about a number of these pieces as we get into the presentation here, but this is a nice shot of some of the self-propelled equipment, as I said, sugarcane harvester up in the top left, forage harvester, and our self-propelled mower conditioner in the bottom left, and the more traditional combines. You'll see we've done some interesting things with the combines as we get through here. Slide 11 is a shot of some of the pull-type equipment that we have available and that we're working with. Pull-type mower conditioners, gathering equipment. We've got different types of rakes for trying to pull the materials together. Both large square and the round balers that we've been working with, accumulators and infield manipulating equipment. And so, going to slide 12. Some of the more specialized equipment, I mentioned the forage harvester, and we're able to do quite a bit of a wide variety of harvesting techniques with this forage harvester. As we talk about the feedstocks, I'll get into a lot more detail on this, but in general, with the half a dozen different types of heads that we've got available for this machine, no modifications to the machine, just changing the head, we were able to attack all sorts of crops. On the go, we can adjust the cut length from roughly a little less than a quarter of an inch to over 1.5 inches, and that's on the go. By doing some other modifications to the machine, we can go to a little farther extremes at both ends. So this is quite a diverse machine, giving us a lot of opportunities for different chop lengths anyway. So going to slide 14, looking at some of the specific feedstocks we've been working with. Corn cobs has been something that's caught a lot of our interest. Some of the other OEMs and short line companies have been focusing on cabs based on activities from Polk up in the upper Midwest, where they're looking at taking the corn cob itself and converting that to an ethanol fuel in a second generation type ethanol conversion process. On slide 15 is one of the techniques that we've been using, minimum modifications to the combine that a prototype piece of equipment behind the combine you're looking at on page 15. This cob cart is something that allows us to, on the go, collect the loose cobs out of the back end of the combine. Now all the material other than grain goes through the combine as normal, and then with the cob cart we're able to do a level of cleaning so that we can get quite pure cobs down to no cleaning at all, and that would give maybe somewhere around maybe 20% material other than cob in that loose mix. On slide 16 is another manner that we're looking at collecting cobs and husks. Also looking at the multiple applications, but it's been the work with Poet and their desire for cobs that has really got us going down here. But in this setup, like the clean cob, loose cobs, we're collecting everything coming out of the back of the combine, and with different adjustments on the header, we can vary the amount of material other than cob going into the bale, anywhere roughly from maybe 20% down to as low as 5% material other than cob. We're looking at 17. A lot of the work that I'll be going through here in the next few minutes, we work with a number of cooperators. Some were very actively involved in, some were just kind of bystanders and assisting where possible. Along with the work that we've been doing trying to collect cobs for Poet, there's been some storage studies, and last fall was an excellent year to collect wet samples. And so we've been working with Idaho National Lab, and I suspect at some time in the near future you'll be hearing some of the results from the bale storage study up in the South Dakota area. On slide 18, shifting to straw, we collect straw, particularly in Europe, for some of the cogen work and supporting the industry in Europe. The picture in the top here, though, that's last month down in Kentucky, where we're looking at collecting, again, all the material besides the grain that's going through the combine. And I will say that for those of you that know straw, you'll see some of the prettiest straw you've ever seen coming out of a combine like this. Slide 19, getting into a little more traditional type collection activity and equipment, corn stover. We've been doing a lot of work with our round baler and our large square balers on collecting corn stover. Some of the activities include looking at controlling the amount of material removed. The other thing we've been trying to do is be a little selective in what we're harvesting or collecting here. Maybe a couple of comments about both the round baler and the square baler. We do have all sorts of options, and there's people that don't typically work with agricultural equipment or the dealers. It's important as you're formulating strategies to work with your dealer to know what types of options are available. Now, in engineering, we're doing the tuning we can to make sure we're able to approach these different conditions, but there are a lot of kits available through our dealer that will assist and make our bailers, both round and square, a little more productive in these sorts of conditions, in the way of pickups, times, and some different guards and things. Also have knives available, and I'll mention this at this point, on both these balers, on the round baler, I think we can put in up to 15 knives, giving you a cutting the material. I think the minimum cut's about 2.5 inches we can achieve on the round baler, and it's approximately 3 inch cut, nominal cut, on the large square baler. So you can do some infield processing. Slide 20, some of our compadres down in Texas have been working with, and this we've been a little more on the side, but trying to support as much as possible, looking at energy sorghum. And 21, I'm sure from Texas A&M, some of you have already seen and heard some of the preliminary reports. We'll hear more, I'm sure, in the future on different storage and handling techniques for energy sorghum. Looking at different ways of cutting, and like I said, storage. On page 22, something that seems to have gained a fair amount of interest just recently is sweet sorghum. Unlike the energy sorghum, the sweet sorghum, the component of interest here is the juice. Now, once the juice is extracted, the rest of the material can be used as other cellulosic material, but the real desire here is to extract the juice. And that being the case, one of the things we're looking at right now is length of cut versus lost juice. And so starting with the sugarcane harvester, we're looking at the different lengths of cut we can get and how that might compare to other harvesting techniques to collect the most juice, but also have the most throughput through the machine. So slide 23, switching to switchgrass. We've been involved with switchgrass probably for 5 years now, cutting from Canada down to Tennessee and a couple of states in between. And the switchgrass has worked out pretty well for us. With the mowers, with our pull-type mowers, center pivot, we find that we're able to get in some of these irregular fields quite well. Even big fields, it's even better and easier. Both the round balers and the square balers, we've been quite happy with what we've been able to do with minimal tuning of the equipment. So slide 24, moving to Miscanthus, and this is something that we've got involved in more so in Europe, but just recently we've been getting involved here in the States, looking at different mowing techniques and what we need to do to the mower, cutting directly with the forage harvester. And the only work that our group, that the advanced engineering group, the innovation group that I head up has been involved in, has been with the large square baler. I'm not aware of any work that our company's done with round baling. But the Miscanthus is something that looks quite interesting and something we're excited to be working with. The picture up in the top right corner, that was just this a few months ago in March, I guess it was, up in Illinois, and we were really, that was our first attempt with the pull-type mower, and we were quite pleased with how we were able to get in there and work with that. About the only thing that we had to be sure to have was our push-by on there, which helped with that long crop. We're 25, the woody crop, this is something that we've been involved in for probably the last 6 years. Mostly working with Jim Volk up at the State University of New York systems out of Syracuse, with willow, and more recently getting involved with some poplar harvesting. But as I said earlier when I was talking about the forage harvester, the real interesting thing here is that with minimal modifications to the forage harvester, the addition of hydraulic drive, which is an option, and that's about it. And then this header, we're able to get in there and cut willow and poplar materials up to where we wouldn't want to do it all day. We're able to cut materials that up to seven inches or so in diameter. Maybe before I move on, just an idea of some of the throughput. I started about mentioning who CNH was because of we're working with people that haven't always been involved in agriculture, and some of the people that I've been running into and my colleagues are being pushed a little bit on productivity, how many acres, how many tons an hour. You hear a lot of discussion about dry tons per acre. Well, you know, so much of the equipment that I'm showing you now is extremely dependent on the conditions in the field. Most of you that's been involved in agriculture, I apologize for standing on my soapbox here, but it's so dependent on the length of field, how much turning you have to do, the productivity, the logistics in the field. Our forage harvester in good standing forage, corn silage, if you've got 40 tons per acre wet out in the southwest, we're able to fill a 15-ton wagon in 5 minutes. We can move a lot of material. The productivity is amazing, but you have to have you have to count on 20 loads per hour. So 20 trucks, 15-ton trucks moving that material to keep things going. One truck gets out of line, or if you're going too far, your logistics stream can shut things down pretty quick. And that's ideal type conditions. You get into something like what's on slide 25, some of the woody crops. Well, probably you're not going to see much more than 2 acres an hour. So the product, the ability to move through these fields is varies quite a bit. Anyway, we're off at 25. On to our lessons learned on 27. We've learned a lot of lessons, and one of the lessons is that you need to control your expectations. Don't expect that first step into the field to look perfect. There's tuning that has to be done and adjustments, and on slide 28 you can see that with the right focus we can do in many crops what I think everybody on the line's hoping we're able to do. That bale that you're looking at on 28, that was made with the combine baler that you just saw on slide 27. That bale is approximately 85% cob. As I mentioned earlier when I was talking about the combine baler combination, we're able to make bales up to 95% cob. The one thing is they are pretty shaky on how many times you're going to be able to handle them. But you get into a bale like this, 85-90% cob, the rest material other than grain, you've got a very nice bale. Some of the other lessons learned on 29, logistics. I mentioned that with the forage harvester just a couple of slides ago. The logistics are critical. How you open the field, getting the bales out of the way. If you are used to unloading on the go, well, that bale you just had dropped on the last pass is right in your road. So there has to be active in the field, a retrieval going on to get those bales out of your way. But more important on this slide is the lesson of logistics. Slide 30. You know, last fall was a wet fall. Unlike if you get into a wet spot in a combine with nothing behind you, I'll tell you right now, if you have a baler behind you, you're not going to back out of that hole. So either you better avoid wet spots, have tracks, or I'm not sure what, but there are challenges above and beyond the normal challenges of farming. On slide 31, what you're seeing here is us trying to find the limits. And when you get into crops, the top left forage harvester, you get into crops that are down, you get into some of the biomass on the lower right-hand corner that the windrows are not aligned very nicely, aren't feeding properly. You cannot plan on running at the typical speeds that you would in normal agricultural crops under good conditions. So I guess the lesson learned here, the comment, unless you want to do like the two young fellows down the lower left, where you're going to lose a lot of time trying to clean a bug machine out, is start slow and work your way up to the speeds, learn your limits, and work with people like us or our other competitors to come up with the tuning needed for the specific crop. Okay, I'm going to shift here a little bit now to using some of the biofuels on the farm, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, and as I look at the clock, we'll probably have plenty of time for questions and answers. But so on the biofuels, going to slide 33 and 34, we've done quite a bit of work with Penn State and Utah State, and then going to slide 35, developing our engines to be to accept D100. And so where we've got D100, that's the biodiesel fuels that meet our engineering spec. We are good today for B100. Then it is critical to be sure that they meet our engineering spec. Slide 36, in Europe I mentioned the biogas, the methane is awfully popular. And we're able to take advantage of our relationship with the Fiat Chrysler group. We are one of Fiat sectors, and so we're able to take advantage of some of the automotive technology and adapt that to our equipment. I'll mention that in the picture on the lower right-hand side, it really does not take four people to fuel this tractor up, but you have something fun going on, and everybody wants to be in the picture. Slide 37, some of you may be aware, have seen pictures of our hydrogen fuel cell tractor. The tractor is interesting, but the idea is more on slide 38. And the concept is that using some of the methane gas from the gas generation systems, the on-farm methane gas producers, to go through a reformer, getting the hydrogen, and then using that on the tractor. So the slide 38 kind of gives the concept idea behind our working with the fuel cell tractor. So that takes us down to the teaser slides here. Jumping to slide 40, the ultimate harvesting system. I have a black box there. I was afraid somebody from John Deere or AGCO might be online. I didn't want to show all of our secrets right now. But actually, the ultimate harvesting system, we need a lot of people's help. Most of the people might be online right now, and if we go to slide 41, the key thing here is there an ultimate conversion system? And I don't think so, but if there is, we need to know what that conversion system is so that we can make sure we're recommending and working with the right equipment. And so some of the questions that we ask the professionals online now and the experts is the conversion systems, are they open to a wide variety of feedstocks, or are they focused on a specific feedstock or a component like corn cobs? And if it is very specifically focused, well, some, something like carbs, you've seen we've been able to approach that and do a good job with that. Is the system going to be able to handle wet and or dry material, or do we have to be harvesting at a very specific time of the year with a short window to harvest and then storage requirements? And then any pre-treatment, you know, I've talked a fair amount about the forage harvester and the ability to adjust the size of chop in the field, and I think most people will agree that a shearing action for size reduction is probably one of the lower energy requirements. If there is size reduction and the forage harvester is the right machine, well, that's something we can work with if that sort of required. Any sorting, cleaning in the field, those are the sorts of things that we have always done. Our combines specifically do that. So if you can help me with what the ultimate conversion system is, I know that not only New Holland, but our friendly competitors, we can all help come up with the right ultimate harvesting solution. And with that, I probably talked faster than I intended, but I'm going to open it up for any kind of questions you might have.
Thank you very much, John. Great presentation. And as you said, it's open for questions now.
Okay, let me, this is Sam Tegel from DOE. Hey, John, I saw on your co-op collection, one pile looked like a shredded cobs. And also, I think you showed a rectangular bale with husks and cobs and together. In your the field demonstration in Iowa, Emmitsburg, I happened to be there, but CNH was not there. So if it is a proprietary answer, don't tell me. My question is it I saw a bunch of their rectangular bales, which they said roughly, as you said, 70-80% co-ops, and remaining is husks and leaves and so forth, collecting all in one pass. And is that still the CNH theory as well? Because John Diaz and others were there, whereas CNH might be doing separately. So that's what I'm saying. Is it a shredded form of cobs, or is it a packed with husk, which the others are doing, or do you have a different idea?
Well, Sam, let's make sure I understand the question. I guess I'm looking at the slide 27 and 28, and that the 28 in particular shows a nice rectangular bale.
I'm looking at the slide 14, okay, where you show cob collection activities, which seem to me shredded cobs. Do you shred cobs, or you simply pack it with the husk?
No, we are not shredding the cobs. In fact, actually, with our combine, they come out quite whole. And so on slide 15, the cob cart that you see there is a CNH design, and that it is designed to collect the loose cob. And the pile of cobs on page 14, I cannot tell you that is out of our cob cart, but I will tell you that the cobs coming out of our cob cart will look similar to that. We've been able to get our cobs down to 5% material other than cob.
Okay.
If the desire is a clean, loose cob with our prototype equipment, I'm not going to tell you that this is going to go into production or anything, but our prototype piece of equipment on slide 15 is able to do that.
Okay. All right. Another question is on your sweet sorghum in Florida. You talked about extracting the juice and then using the cellulosic. Is it pretty much like sugarcane, extracting the juice and using the bagasse?
The concept that I'm aware of is exactly like sugarcane, yes. For us, as I mentioned right when I got started, our focus is in the field and trying to meet the conversion facilities requirements. But right now, that's right. The group down there is trying to extract the juice through a crushing process and then use the juice for direct conversion to ethanol, and then the bygas, if you will, from the wheat sorghum as the energy source for that conversion process.
Okay, a little one, last one is, you said, I think you have been working with the Idaho National Lab regarding the storage and how to set the bales from microbial action and dry matter loss and so forth. I mean, do you have any ideas till now, lessons learned? Are you still waiting for some results? Do you know how to store, how much to store, what to do about those in-field storage of the bales? Any idea, anything you can tell us?
No, Sam, probably nothing appropriate for the level of people on this call. I think probably most of the people understand some of the biological activity much better than I do. The one thing I'll say is that with as wet as the material was we were baling, some of those bales up to 40% moisture, they look a whole lot better than I ever would have thought. And some of the temperatures, the preliminary information I've heard from Idaho National Lab, some of the peak temperatures reached were lower than my past experience would have ever had me think. I'm not ready at all to have any conclusions, but this corn stover handled a whole lot different than I was thinking. Under traditional practices, we would have been very concerned with anything even as high as 18% moisture. With this 20% moisture, I'm not sure if it was just so wet it handled differently, but I know Idaho National Labs has been monitoring that, I believe, on a monthly basis, and I'm sure there's going to be a nice report coming out of those people.
Thank you. Thanks.
My name's Fred. I'm from the USDA and ARS out in Pennsylvania, and I'm also from a large custom harvesting farm up in northern Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And I have a couple of questions about the baling system that's pulled behind the combine.
Okay.
First of all, can you explain a little bit the driving mechanism on that? Is it a PTO drive that's going to literally just hook up to, you know, a standard baling PTO drive, or is it a whole different setup you got going on there?
I didn't get into any of the details, but on the combine we have relatively minor modifications. On the baler, the modifications have been a bit more extreme. We have taken off the PTO drive line, and we are now powering the baler hydraulically. And if you do a search, a Google search for Glenbar, what we've done is working with Glenbar out of Australia, and I understand that there's a agreement here in North America with Cuthill now, but I don't know any details. But we started with the Glenbar system, made some of our own modifications, and that's what we've been working with. So the combine has a we've increased the hydraulics and are taking the hydraulics off the combine and driving the baler hydraulically. And then other than the conveyor between the two, that's really about it.
Okay, and you have a separate pump for the baler then that's going to charge the hydraulic pressure to the combine or to the baler, so you're not running, you know, bogging down the combine or something?
There is a separate pump piggyback on the combine, but as you can imagine, that power is coming from somewhere.
Right.
So even though it's a mechanical connection, it's not stealing hydraulics from the combine, that it is stealing power from the combine. You know, so we, you know, that baler is going to take, depending on the conditions, somewhere around 100 horsepower from the combine.
Okay. And a last question about the combine. Do you have any sort of flotation set up or some kind of tracks or larger tires that you have recommended or out as like a kit for especially baling on corn stover ground that might be wet?
Well, actually, on the combine, we do have tracks. Right now, we are not in a position yet to say this is an acceptable practice.
Okay.
And so, but where we've been working with people trying it, we've been strongly recommending a powered rear axle, and if you are in muddy conditions, well, then the track sure would make sense.
Other questions?
John, this is Richard Haig, who is also with USDA. I had a question about getting back to your harvester, the husks and the cobs, and you said you can adjust that for more cobs or more husks. And how is that, what kind of mechanism is it that makes that adjustment?
Richard, it's more just tweaking the pincher rolls on the header.
Oh.
Much as anything, or raising the head a little bit, trying to have less material go through it. It's nothing near as extreme as varieties make.
Okay.
This last fall we got into a half a dozen different varieties, and there are some varieties that, and it kind of appeared as though it was a white cob in general, had more husk attached to them than the red cobs. But I can't tell you the varieties, and I'm not even sure it was a difference between the red and the white, but there were some of the varieties that we were into this past fall that it was night and day difference on what the bales looked like.
Okay.
All because of the husk sticking to the cob.
Another question related to the balers, and I realize you've made the point that CNH is looking at using what you have as present equipment and then fine-tuning it for the biomass. But long term, what would be the goal you would think for density? Because many people think about these density of the bales, you can get it more dense, therefore hauling this material is going to be more suitable economically. Do you have a goal of where you'd like to be in pounds per square foot?
Yeah, that's a good question, Richard. You know, when we're in the field with our round bales and square bales, in the field, at field moisture, we can load a truck. We can load a truck out. Now, everybody is interested in the dry matter per cubic foot or metric units and what you're going to have. But when you're in the field, and if you've got say, one of our silage bales, and we're up over a ton of bale on a 3x4 by 8 foot bale, you're going to load out a truck.
Okay.
No trouble. And so, you know, the goal, it absolutely would be a nice goal, and I've seen it in some of the work from the preliminary next billion ton study to have over 16 pounds per cubic foot of dry matter, and we are, and I'm sure our friends at the other companies are doing our best at achieving that.
Okay.
But there has to be some caution that if those 16 pound or 15 pound per cubic foot of dry matter bales baled when they're at 50% moisture, you're going to have one heck of a heavy bale.
Yeah, you're right. I understand. Okay. Another question for you, John, if looking at your experience with these cellulose crops, can you predict or estimate where the major winners are going to be in the cellulose crops? from the cellulose to miscanthus to sorghum, field sorghum, and... Or is that all going to be based on regionality?
No, I think that's right. I was trying to think of a clever comment about where I'd be if I could answer those kind of questions. But Richard, I think it's so much regional that just like the ultimate harvesting system. You think today of a dairy farm, the ultimate dairy farm. Well, the cows I see up in upstate New York and then out in California, those cows look exactly the same to me, but the processing and the equipment that we have to tune and develop for the farming in those areas is very different. And I think with the bio feedstocks and conversions, there's even going to be more differentiation. I'm not sure. You think of miscanthus planting with rhizomes, or versus a seeded crop. Well, from the equipment side, I think we're going to get there a lot quicker if we can use some of our 90-foot wide seeders to get crops established quickly. But I'm sure not willing to cross out miscanthus. In fact, that's exactly why I've got such a variety of slides of the materials we've been working with. It's going to be experts like the people on the line that are going to be able to tell us better which ones truly have the best, the cradle-to-grave energy balance. And we want to make sure that we're able to work with whichever ones of those are the winner. And we think we've got the right equipment lineup, to touch most of these.
Well, I just want to thank you, John, for your presentation, and these slides were very beneficial and very helpful and well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Other questions, folks?
John, this is Randy Raper, also with USDA, with ARS, out here in Boonville, Arkansas.
Yes, sir.
Got a question for you about slide 25. You're showing basically harvesting of woody crops using some of your machinery, and I apologize, I came in late and didn't hear all of it. What is the maximum size woody crop that you think that you'd be comfortable harvesting with a machine like that?
Well, if you were a customer looking to buy the harvester, what we're saying is ideally 2 to 6 inches in diameter and down at the ground level. We've been working with some of these foresters, and as we talk to them, they talk about it breast height. Well, when we get into something that they say 6 inches at breast height, and they've been throwing us for a loop, and we have been able to cut stuff 8 inches at the ground, but that's not something that we're designed for. Really, we've got at the ground. So looking at slide 25, you can see that willow tree has multiple branches. As long as none of those branches are much bigger than 6 inches, we can cut at one time multiple stems. But if you're in the 2 to 5 inch range, we'll be able to have some pretty high performance.
How feasible do you think it is to have one machine that might be able to function in some sort of an agroforestry concept where you've basically got small woody plants like that along with maybe a perennial and an annual thrown out there? Do you think that's feasible at all?
Well, if you look at what slide was that, one of the beginning ones with the harvester, slide 12. So what I could imagine, as you're talking, would be, say, willows or poplar planted, 30 feet apart. I don't know what the right distance is, but with a herbaceous crop in between, switchgrass or something else, and that forage harvester would be able to direct cut then material in between, and with no modifications to the harvester at all other than changing the head, you'd be able to come back in and cut the woody crop. I think what you're saying,
we're losing you, John. You still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you hear?
I can hear you now.
Yeah, we missed the last part of your answer, but that's crazy. I appreciate your comments on that. Thank you.
Okay. I think it's very possible. So.
John, this is Bob. I had a question, actually. So it seems like from your presentation, you're pretty confident that most of the needs for harvesting biomass today can be handled by existing equipment. Is that,
Bob, I think the initial, particularly supporting some of the pilot scale operations, I think we've got the right equipment with either minor tuning or modifications that we can help support those pilot builds and better understand what the best long-term production needs are. Now, some of the shortliners are in a better shape and they're quicker at being able to adapt to needs, but some of us larger OEM full-line companies, we're going to have to start at this slow, better understand what the long-term needs are. Now, as we first started working with cobs, we were told they had to be perfectly clean. And the longer we worked and the more experience everybody had, well, people found that the enzymes were a little more flexible, could work with husks. And the difference between a machine that has less than 5% material other than cob to a machine that's able to give you something with 15% material other than cob, for an OEM like us, that's an unbelievably significant difference. And so we want to know those things up front. And back to your question, I think what we've got now is good for helping out, getting the pilots established and better knowing what the conversions really have to have. And then we can come up with that ultimate black box machine for the ton an hour type conversion.
Great, thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions, folks?
I have one more question for him. If you wanted to use a corn stover instead of for an ethanol, you instead wanted to use it for a bioheat or, you know, break it down and pelletize it. Is there any way or any mechanism, any design, whatever that you have out there that you could potentially cut a higher percentage of the corn stover total biomass at the corn head, put it through the combine, and then take it right straight through the combine and bale it all in one pass?
One of the things all the OEMs, anybody making combines, has tried to do is get as little material other than the grain going through the combine just for the efficiency of the combine. And so when you think of even straw or wheat, the small grains, you know, a lot of people cut very high just so that they do keep the material other than grain going through. That it takes a lot of power to run that material, and then more importantly to try to separate the grain from all that material. It would be possible to do what you're suggesting, but I'm having a hard time imagining what that combine would look like and how much power would need in sieves and concaves and everything to clean and separate that grain. It could be done though.
Okay. And then for the disc bines, those mowers, for the conditioners, do you recommend using the standard rollers? And like if we're cutting something like miscanthus or something, switchgrass, something with a high high level of biomass, do you suggest doing like a V-tine conditioner to throw through there? What are your recommendations there?
So the conditioning, probably about the only thing I can say right now comfortably. And you know, conditioning hay is something that CNH has focused a large part of our business on for years. And so the difference between chevrons or twisted steel, or, you know, there's a lot of fine-tuning for the very specific crop you're in. Probably the only conclusion I can tell you right now is that on slide 24, when you're going through some of that heavy crop, initially we thought you might want to back off on the conditioning rolls. Well, I'll tell you what, it doesn't feed, and then you'll end up looking like one of those lessons learned pitchers.
Right. Because I've been one of those two guys pulling on the stuff in the back of the mower, and it's not any fun, yeah?
But you're right. You're right. And so you need to have enough pressure and an aggressive enough conditioning roll to be sure you feed things through. I'm not ready to tell you what's the best. We've only been working with a couple of them so far, and we need to get a little more experience with that. But I'm pretty sure the one that we had there was the steel rolls.
Okay.
Okay, I'm being told no by my colleague here. So we did have the rubber rolls in here, and that worked surprisingly well.
Okay. And you're, right now, are you thinking that like a rotor cutter or something going into that baler is going to get you a better looking bale and a more consistent bale than not having it? You suggest cutting the stalks before putting it in?
You know, it depends on the moisture and what the crop is and what you want. Some of the real dry materials, the switchgrass and the miscanthus is so broken up already, I'm not sure you really even need the knife. But in some of the wetter crops that you would be in, the pre-length cutting probably is a good idea, depending on what the conversion process is going to be.
Okay, thank you.
Well, our hour is up, and I again wanted to thank John for an excellent presentation. I wanted to let you all know that at this point we don't have any teleseminars scheduled for right now for the future. We're going to take a hiatus in August anyway, since that seems to be a heavy vacation month for most. I'm happy to accept any recommendations, suggestions, volunteers who would like to, for presentations in the future, just send me an email, and we will be back in touch, I'm sure. Thank you all again.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.